So this is a symbolic outfit I'm going to wear. At some point I'll ask you guys what you think it symbolizes. But it would have communicated something to folks in Israel back in Micah's day. He shaved his head. I'm not going to do that for y'all. So I'll just be putting... Oh, thank you. Thank you, Rod. I'll just do this in lieu of shaving my head. I'm also not going to mourn like a jackal or like an ostrich. Just saying. This is a pale version of what Micah was doing back in the day. This is also my first time speaking off of a computer here, so I'm desperately hoping that the page comes up. There it is. All right. It's asking me to authenticate, which hopefully I can get past. Okay. So this past winter, I finally unpacked my books from 3 years of having them in boxes with my moves and with my house renovation. And so that was very fun. And I'd been yearning to do some sort of study. So I decided to do a deep dive into an Old Testament book and a deep dive into a New Testament theme. And I chose Micah as my Old Testament one, partly because it's a short book, which I hoped was going to be less complex than the big ones, but also because he has two passages which are two favorites of mine, and I think of yours as well. So one is the passage, "They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. But each one shall dwell under their own vine and under their own fig tree, and none shall make them afraid." And that's my picture of God's kingdom, of the kingdom of God. So next Sunday I'll be focusing on that passage and asking you what your vision of the kingdom of God, what your picture is. And the other passage in Micah, which we had in our entryway, is "What does the Lord require of you?" So I'll look at that in 2 weeks, that passage. So for today, I thought I wanted to kind of give a just an intro to Micah. Why did he say those things? That was one thing I was curious about. What made it necessary for him to say them? Did his words make any difference? Prophets say some really hard things. Did anything come of it? So also, was he a typical Old Testament prophet? Did he bring something new to biblical theology? Was there a shift around his time? Those are some of the things I want to look at today. So if you want to just picture a man barefoot, his head shaved, calling like a coyote or an ostrich, wearing pretty plain clothing. In the book, he says he's naked, but as far as I can tell, that referred to not having the outer garments on. And so I also saved you that picture. many Old Testament books are in poetry, in poetic form, and the prophets are in that literary tradition. And as I was reading him, I really dug into the book before I started reading commentaries, and I'm like, well, he just said that in the preceding verse. Well, that's Hebrew poetry. It's parallelism. He says one thing in one line, and he repeats it, the theme, in the next line with different words. Also, probably Micah did not write his book. He spoke it. The prophets were speakers. And so you can picture him shouting at a public spot, the city gate, the marketplace, the temple, where people are really busy going about their business, and he has to do something to be heard. And obviously these prophets did that because people did write down their words. one of the scholars says they spoke in short, arresting speeches and poetry. Perhaps that was necessary in settings where they prophesied, for they appear to have been uninvited and unwelcome, and presumably did not have time to speak at greater length. So you got to say something really quickly, and it's got to catch their attention. Marcus Borg pictured it as a street theater with intention getting symbolic actions. And probably scholars think they didn't enjoy this call from God. Abraham Heschel said, none of the prophets seems enamored with being a prophet, and you can read that in Jeremiah and Amos. It's both a distinction and an affliction. The prophet bears scorn and reproach. He is stigmatized as a madman by some people. There were some women prophets too, but the famous names are the men. So here's a question I'm working with today. When you see people you love doing something that will lead them into a catastrophe, what do you do? I think that was the dilemma of the classical Old Testament prophets from Amos through Joel and Malachi. One scholar says, Amos mysteriously and suddenly strode onto the historical scene to be followed by other prophets. Most of them were among the greatest poets who ever lived. Then 3 centuries after Amos started this astonishing parade, it ground to a halt. And he has a theory as to why, but we'll get there later, perhaps. So Amos strode onto the scene around 200 years after Solomon's United Kingdom split into 2 countries. And I'm going to pretend this is a map. I didn't pull off getting a map. So over here, so this is the Mediterranean Sea over there. Here's the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, the Dead Sea. So here's Israel. That's the United Kingdom. At the time of Micah, there's the Northern Kingdom, Israel, with its capital, Samaria. The southern kingdom, Judah, was its capital of Jerusalem. So Amos was in the northern kingdom around 750 BCE, before Christ. And when he strode onto the scene, things were pretty peaceful. The two kingdoms were having pretty prosperous years. Things looked good. And he was really lambasting the kings, or the king at that point. And it was a bit mysterious why he would do that, because it was peace and prosperity at that point. But storm clouds were gathering, international storm clouds, and also internal storms were in full gale. So we'll get to the international in a bit, but you can picture a big threat. Or a looming potential threat to the smaller countries, of which Samaria and Judah were two. So the internal storm inside Israel had been building up since Israel began the kingship system. With a king, the economy shifted out of smaller financial structures of tribes to somehow find enough money to pay for a palace, to have a temple and palace be built, for infrastructure, waterways, and to fight wars. Samuel had warned back when God asked him to anoint Saul, here's what a king will do to Israel. We'll take their sons as warriors, conscript them into labor battalions to work the king's fields, take their daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers, take the best of their fields and vineyards and orchards and give them to his friends. Take 1/10 of your grain and flocks. Take your slaves and the best of your animals for his own work. And you shall be the king's slaves, said Samuel. So how did Israel pay for that form of government? It was taxation and forced labor. So we're familiar with taxation 2,500 years later. We don't, well, we could talk about whether we have forced labor in the U.S., but Back then, that was a big way that especially the huge projects got done. And the forced labor was the reason the two kingdoms split, actually. So that's a historical and very potent issue in those days. When Solomon died, his son refused to lighten the load of the northern tribes, and so they broke off. They wouldn't accept him as king. But they kept the kingship structure. Some people in this dividing economy even had to sell themselves or their children. So the poor folks had little bits of land, ideally. You get bad weather, you get a year of no rains, you get whatever, you go into debt. So people went into debt slavery, like we have debtor's prison, or we used to. Perhaps we do again. People would have to sell themselves to other people with money, or they would sell their kids. They would sell their children because they had nothing. They had nothing to pay their bills with. So the Levitical law said you can own slaves, but they need to be from other countries. You can't own other Israelites as slaves. So from today's point of view, that has its problems. But that was the law for them. So not only were the poor losing their land and becoming slaves to the wealthy, there were also probably refugees coming down from the northern kingdom into Jerusalem. Micah was in the southern kingdom. And so there was just chaos, poverty, division of great wealth as well. So those were offensive to the prophets that in Micah's time, which are Amos, Hosea, Micah, and Isaiah. Micah and Isaiah were at the same time. Those 8th century prophets were known for lambasting the rich and the powerful. And they all felt that it was hypocritical of four groups in power to think that God would bless them when they weren't taking God seriously. So the Passover wasn't being held, the great festivals, the law wasn't being followed, and this combination really offended these prophets. And Micah names the four groups. He names judges, so the people supposed to carry out the law, business people. He talks about how they cheated on their scales, and I was reminded that at the farmer's market, the vendors have to get their scales approved by, I guess, the health department, the county health department. I don't know if that's a state law, but so we've made sure in the U.S. that you can't cheat on your scales. But back then they were charging too much. They were cheating on their scales. Political rulers are the third group, and institutional prophets. Institutional prophets were usually paid by the king, and those aren't the ones whose names we know who are in the books of the Bible. They were the yes men, more or less. So as I was working with Micah, I came to think that these prophets speak to both sides of our political divide and religious divide today. different scholars have seen different things in them, but to me they have both a concern for those who are concerned with the loss of faith, with the loss of tradition, with forgetting the ways of the past. The prophets really honored those. But their concerns also resonate with folks who want more justice, more peace, more social change. Because they very much saw those two going hand in hand. So I came with my own agenda and wanted to see certain things in the text. And I think that both of those were very essential for the prophets. They couldn't see one without the other. The international storm cloud was that, so that was the internal storm going on. The international one is that when Amos was speaking to the people in the midst of peace and prosperity about the doom to come, a new king, Tilgath-Pileser III, took the throne in Assyria, and he was a huge threat to the area. And in fact, he took Gaza. I'm not sure how the water, but countryside by Assyria. And that's when Hezekiah came to the throne. So that's the third king that Micah knew. And so the kings in Israel had to pay tribute to these guys in order for them not to invade. And there would be rebellions when a new king would take the throne to try to get out of paying the tribute. But the prophets, Isaiah, really wanted them to just keep paying the tribute. So we will listen to the context. I'm going to invite Jerry to come up and read this passage from the first three chapters of Micah, these snippets. And I want to invite you to listen to whether there's any parallelism, any poetry that you're picking up in these particular passages.
I'm not going to list each separate verse because it's on your bulletin, but I am reading from a different translation. I'm reading from the New Jerusalem Bible translation. The word of Yahweh, which came to Micah of Moresheth during the reigns of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, his visions about Samaria and Jerusalem. Listen, all you peoples, attend, earth and everyone in it. Yahweh intends to give evidence against you, the Lord, from his holy temple. All this is because of the crime of Jacob, the sin of the house of Israel. What is the crime of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? What is the sin of the house of Judah? Is it not Jerusalem? So I shall make Samaria a ruin in the open country, a place for planting vines. I shall send her stones rolling into the valley until I have laid her foundations bare. This is why I shall howl and wail, why I shall go barefoot and naked, why I shall howl like the jackals, why I shall shriek like the desert owls. For there is no cure for the wounds that Yahweh inflicts. The blow falls on Judah. It falls on the gateway of my people, on Jerusalem itself. Disaster for those who plot evil, who lie in bed planning mischief. No sooner is it dawn than they do it, since they have the power to do so. Seizing the fields that they covet, they take over houses as well. Owner and house they seize alike, the man himself as well as his inheritance. So Yahweh says this, "Look, I am now plotting a disaster for this breed from which you will not extricate your necks. You will not hold your heads up then, for the times will be disastrous indeed. Kindly listen to this, you leaders of the house of Jacob, you princes of the house of Israel who detest justice, wresting it from its honest course, who build Zion with blood and Jerusalem with iniquity. Her leaders give verdicts for presents. Her priests take a fee for their rulings. Her prophets divine for money. And yet they rely on Yahweh. Isn't Yahweh among us, they say? No disaster is going to overtake us. That is why, thanks to you, Zion will become plowland, Jerusalem a heap of rubble, and the Temple Mount a wooded height."
So those last couple verses were really shocking as Micah was shouting out his brief poetic beliefs and statements to people that Jerusalem and the temple were going to be destroyed. That was pretty shocking and quite offensive that God was not going to protect it. Why in the world would God not protect it? So as you heard Micah saying how he dressed, what do you think his garb was symbolizing to people around him? There are two things that the scholars say symbolized. Any ideas? I will howl like the jackals. I will mourning. Yep, exactly. Grief and mourning are one. There's a lot of references in the Bible to tearing your cloth and such, tearing your clothing. Exile was another. This what he wore was evidently very simple, and when people were on the road in these rows, heading on dusty roads to the place they were being sent, they wore either something very simple or something that was given to them. I don't know, but it was. So he was conveying a person in grief and also a person heading into exile. Walter Brueggemann, an Old Testament scholar, said in his famous book, The Prophetic Imagination, which has been really influential, said that the capacity to grieve is the starting point for changing things. Without expressing grief, without complaining, without people using their voice, God evidently won't act. It takes that first groan of the heart, or in the New Testament would be the splanx gizomai. I remember that from my Greek class, the gut, a cry to God. And then God hears and acts on that. So Micah is doing this first step towards getting God to intervene. Micah raises his voice on behalf of the poor, who really were too tired, too burdened by getting through each day to make any protest. They were just trying to survive. So I don't know if you noticed some of the parallelism in that. He also used literary puns in chapter 1. He had about 10 towns which are going to be rolled over in the coming invasion. The writer of the message, I forget his name, said, in Dustville, roll in the dust. In Alarm Town, the alarm is sounded. He would take the meaning of each town's name and then do a play on it. And so my own version would be, your beautiful fountain will be knocked over, Bell Fountain. Zane long ago left his field, Zane's field. Micah was naming each town and the disaster, or a poetic form of the disaster that was going to come on it. He was from a village, Moresheth, which was about 25 miles southwest of Jerusalem, pretty much on the way to Gaza. And even though he was a country boy, it's obvious that he knew the Hebrew scriptures, and so I'm guessing he was literate. But he really, you could tell that he just lived them, at least the words that got written down about him, he'd probably memorized and had in his being. Somehow, even as a village boy, he had access to King Hezekiah, who came to the throne in 725. And that Hezekiah came right before the new king of Assyria came and took Israel. And in fact, in 722, the country of Israel ceased to exist. That was the end of its history. Last king, that was it. They became an administrative state of Assyria. So this is the time in which Micah is prophesying, probably before that happened, all these horrible things going to happen. And it's going to happen to you too, Jerusalem, what happened to Samaria. And he says, why is this going to happen? And it's because of their practices and because of not worshiping God correctly. So Micah is remembered 100 years later. I'm going to invite our readers to come up and read a story from Jeremiah in which 100 years later, Jeremiah is on trial for saying the same thing to the king that Micah had said in these verses.
Don't listen and turn back from their bad lives. I'll make this temple a pile of ruins like Shiloh, and I'll make this city nothing but a bad joy for a while. Everyone there, priests, prophets, and people, heard Jeremiah to this message in the temple of God. When Jeremiah finished his sermon, saying everything God commanded him to say, the priests and prophets and people all grabbed him together.
Thank you. Thank you for that reading. So that was 100, maybe 150 years after Micah. And Jeremiah did live to see Jerusalem sacked. And that was when the Babylonian kingdom was on the ascendancy. And they came in and carted the Jews off to Babylonia. So that prophecy came through in Jeremiah's time, or came true. But it didn't in Micah's. And so he had spoken truth to power, even though he was 150 years ahead of what was going to happen. Probably after that interaction between Micah and Hezekiah, we know that Hezekiah began a religious reform. He even got them to Israel to do the Passover, which they hadn't been doing, and various religious celebrations. He had the temple cleaned out. There's stories in, I think, 2 Kings about all the work the helpers had to do to clean out all the rubble that was in the temple, all the stuff laying around with years of disuse. And Hezekiah also stopped paying tribute when a new king came on the throne, and that king wasn't going to have anything of it. Sennacherib was his name, and he besieged Jerusalem for 3 years. So if you want to imagine not having access to food for 3 years, Hezekiah knew this might be coming, and he'd built waterways, so they probably did have water. But they lived for 3 years under siege. And for some mysterious reason to the historians, Sennacherib did not take Hezekiah away, did not conquer Jerusalem. So Micah would see this, and a lot of religious scholars see that as God rewarding Hezekiah for turning and reinstituting religious ritual. We don't hear much about him bringing more justice, social justice. I'm hoping that happened. But Hezekiah made it through that particular invasion. Sennacherib went home, which is a mysterious thing to the historians, but not mysterious to the religious scholars. And Micah is giving credit for saving the nation at that point. So if people you loved could avoid catastrophe, if they changed their behavior, what would you do? If you could see that they could change their ways and avert something horrible, what would you do? I don't know what I would do, frankly, but we see catastrophes around us. For Micah, what we see is that he grieved loudly and publicly. He spoke truth to power, and in this case, the power listened. And as we heard in that story, it wasn't always safe for the prophets to speak that. The one prophet did get killed, and Jeremiah's life was saved by somebody remembering the story of Micah. One of the scholars says that Micah's mission is not simply to announce calamities, but to lead the people to conversion. And interspersed with these horrible, you know, predictions or condemnations are these beautiful visions, two of which drew me to this book, and we'll talk about them more. So the prophets had both this, you are misbehaving in a terrible way, and here's how it could be. I want to end with poetry and song. It's possible, actually, that the prophets sang. There were temple singers, and so it's not clear whether the prophets sang some of these, but if it was poetry, it's possible they did. So we're going to have a reading. This is a current poem from the current issue of the CPT, the Christian Peacemaker Team magazine. I'm going to ask Steve to come up and read that. And then we will sing whatever that song is, The Road to Basra. And that will be our moment to lament like Micah. Micah might have said these things. Although he named the people responsible, this song actually doesn't do that. So I'll invite Steve to come up and read that piece.
Carla will correct me if I don't explain this correctly. This poem is written in response to an incident in Colombia, and it's in 2003, and they have an organization called the Women's Popular Front, I think, and one of the workers was assassinated by one of the paramilitary groups. And these women were working amongst the poor and vulnerable. And so this poem has been written in response to her death, and I think also other workers. And I think in your program, the title was there, "We did not bury them, we planted them." They are driven by hope. It is like a force that has always been there. It has accompanied them throughout their lives, a life full of bitterness and misfortune. Bitterness and misfortune they have survived. None of them were ever safe, and they never pretended to be, because nobody has ever recognized them, because they have always been unknown. They fight where no one fights, and they live where no one lives. They have turned symbols into their weapons. They no longer speak of burying their dead. They speak of sowing them, of turning them into seeds, seeds that fall into the earth. They become life, protection, and nourishment. They are seeds. They all give life, both in death and in life. They are light. They are strength and hope. They are the symbol that there is no oppression that can overcome love.